There's quite a difference between the first chapter of Genesis and the third chapter of this book. When the volume opens, God is completely in charge. As that first chapter develops, He gradually shares that authority with the man and the woman. He gives them power to subdue certain parts of the creation. He gives them dominion. The man and the woman become sort of vice presidents of the world. They're left in charge. Chapter 2, the man is assigned the task of naming the animals. He's told to care for the garden. These two people look like God. They have some of the same qualities of God because He made them splitting images of Himself. Then comes the biggest surprise in the book of Genesis. The God who created order out of disorder, who created gardens out of chaos, who made the cows and the men out of dirt, who made the woman out of man, the God who surveyed all that had been made and said, "Ah, very good." The God who was concerned when the man was lonely, the God who had created food and sex and life and joy, does something that we don't expect at all. He lets the snake in the garden. The crafty, subtle, cagey snake slithers up next to the naked woman and begins to talk. And he sways her not to leave her husband, not to do destructive things to the garden, not to curse God, not to make an idol, not to look for a better home somewhere else. The snake is much too intelligent to do anything like that. Instead, the snake takes up the one moral law that God has made and tempts the woman to break it. And so she reaches out and picks one of the shiny fruits off the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and she gives it a taste. She cuts off a slice and gives it to her husband, and he takes a bite, and the snake slithers away. Then things begin to happen in rapid succession. They become aware that there's a difference between good and evil. They become aware that they have no clothes on. They become aware that their private parts are exposed. They become aware that when God walks among the shrubs in the gardens, He's not there to look at scenery. They become aware of what it's like to feel guilt. And life suddenly begins to change. They become alienated from the snake. Tension enters history. Pain is introduced. Pregnancy becomes a hard experience. Work becomes a burden. Thorns grow in the weedless gardens. Thistles bite into the farmer's hand. And the couple threatens God's realm. And so He chases them out of His garden, erects barriers to prevent their return. Then brothers don't get along. There's murder, revenge, death. All these become part of the human experience. And so it's a story that begins very nice, but ends up with alienation and fragmentation. The man set opposed to the woman. God and humans are in tension. People and the animals don't get along. People corrupt the earth. The women and the child fight. People don't like their work. And the canvas that looked so bright and cheery just a page or so ago is now colored with dark greens and grays and filled with shadows and drab clouds. But what happened? What went wrong? Who pulled the plug? Why does the very good become not good? Who messed up the system? And why? Well, we have to know, because somewhere here is the reason for our own alienation. We must know. If we can find out what went wrong in the garden, then maybe we can find out what's wrong in our own lives. The story speaks of the same kind of pain and struggle, the despair and the expulsion, the maladjustment, the disappointment that we have. And so we have to know what's going on in the story, because it's also the story of our lives. We've broken the moral law. We've eaten the forbidden fruit. We've passed on the blame. We've avoided the consequences. We've sensed that same alienation and despair. So what's the trouble? What went wrong here? I think the text suggests two things, and I'd like to look at those two things this morning. The first one is a matter of seduction. In verse 13 of the third chapter, the woman makes a remarkable statement. She says that the snake seduced her. She says, "I was tricked. I was deceived. He lured me into it. I was enticed. He led me on. It was a come on. That snake baited me to do this." And she was right. The snake had tricked her. He had lied to her. The snake said, "Did God say you should not eat of any tree in the garden? You go back and check chapter 2. God never said that." The snake tantalized with the truth. Well, the woman caught the snake in his ploy and corrected him. But in the process, she expanded on what God had said. And in her rush to tell the snake that they could eat of the 99 trees, but not of the one tree, she went beyond that. And she said, we can't even touch that one. We're not even going to that part of the garden. We're to stay away from it. And then she reminds the serpent of what will happen if they get close to that tree. She says, if we eat of that tree, we will die. Snake says, no, you won't. The snake disagrees with God. That's not right. You won't die. God has something He doesn't want you to have. And it's out of envy that God made this tree off limits. Well, the woman was hooked. She forgot about the snake. Started looking at the tree. She saw that the tree was a nice-looking tree, but in chapter 2, all the trees that God had made were nice-looking trees. It wasn't that there were 99 ugly trees and one pretty tree. She was tricked into looking at just one. Then she saw it was good for food. Chapter 2 says all the trees were good for food. It wasn't that there were 99 trees with rotten fruit and only one tree with good fruit. She had been seduced. Seduction implies that something happens to us that we're not quite aware of. Beguiled means we've been tricked. And what's going on or what we're doing is not the real us. There's a difference or a tension between what we're doing now and what we think or what we believe at the base of life. For this woman, the tension is clear. She believed in God. She enjoyed this garden. She liked the food from the other trees. But for a moment, she forgot all that and broke God's only moral law. Well, seduction is like that. It was then, it is now. If you ask most people in Memphis about life, what do they say? How's life going for you? Oh, fine. Great. Do you really believe? Do you really feel good about what you're doing? Yes, everything's fine. I was talking to an old friend the other day. It's been years since we talked. Last month, her husband died. I said, how's it going? She said, fine. I'm making it. I'm mostly worried about the children. That wasn't true at all. She was torn up on the inside. She needed tranquilizers to sleep. She hated her husband for dying. Life was miserable. All of her hopes were dashed. She had been seduced into thinking everything was all right when it wasn't. Go down to the ghetto or go out to the suburbs and ask, how's it going? They'll tell you, hey, I have life. I'm healthy. I'm active. I've got a job. I'm into this crowd. I'm doing this. Gallup asked the people who go to church, do you have a clear-cut goal and purpose in life? 82% said yes. He asked the people who don't go to church, do you have meaning in life? 70% said yes. You mean to tell me, Americans, that 7 out of 10 of you have meaning in life? Well, then tell me why there are 265,000 suicides every year. Tell me why 20 million Americans use marijuana. Why 6 million Americans use cocaine. Tell me why 10 million Americans are alcoholics. Tell me why 2.5 million drop out of high school every year. Tell me why 3 million sleep on the street. Tell me why 11.5 million crimes were committed in 1976. Tell me why millions of people are hooked on prescription drugs. People have been beguiled. They tell the pollsters life is going well. They tell the interviewers life is okay. You can watch Johnny Carson laugh about his last divorce and the huge alimony payments he makes. Then you tell me he's being honest with you. Beguiled. Seduced. What we believe doesn't match the way we act. Gallup said 92% of all Americans, 95% if you just count the adults over 30, believe in God. Eve would be included in that number. But she sure didn't act that way. Seduction. It tricks us into acting one way when we actually believe another way. But it's not the only thing going on here in the garden. There's another cause to the trouble Eve gets into. And that is that Eve, and by implication, we ask the wrong questions. Look at the way this woman made her decision about whether or not she's going to eat of this particular tree. She looked at that tree and she wondered, is it good for food? Is this tree safe? Is this tree high in cholesterol? Has this tree been sprayed with pesticides? Is this tree going to hurt me? Is it good? And then she wondered, well, is it a delight to my eye? Will it be pleasant? Will I feel good eating this tree? Will I have a good time? Will it be a comfortable experience for me to take of this fruit? And then she wondered, will it make me wise? What will I get out of this tree? What's in it for me? Will it help me? Is it worth my time? Will it put me ahead? How can I use the fruit of this tree to my own advantage? Well, we can begin at the head of the Bible and read the whole way through and try to figure out what questions people in the Bible were asking. And when they asked the questions that Eve asked, they almost always got in trouble. The people who excel in Scripture are those who ask another set of questions. Now, the questions haven't changed. Americans are asking the same questions Eve asked. Let's just go through them. Number one, is it safe? Is it good for me? That's a fundamental question of our lives. We're all interested in survival. Someone has said that security has become our God. If we're going to buy a house, we want to know that it's in a safe neighborhood. If we're going to buy a car, we want to know how well it does in the crash test, and that's okay, that's fine. The problem comes for Eve, as it does for us, when that's the only question we ask. So, sex is okay, if it's safe sex. Drugs are okay, if the needle's clean. Crime is okay, as long as it's not in my neighborhood. Poverty is okay, as long as we keep it down in the ghetto where it belongs. Taking from the company is okay as long as no individual suffers. Living together is okay as long as nobody gets hurt. Abortion is okay because everybody who can talk is safe. Whether something is safe or not is a good question to ask. But when it's the only question, or the central question, it gets us into trouble. It's striking when God called Abraham. Abraham never asked, is Palestine a safe place to live? When God tapped Moses on the shoulder for service, Moses never asked, why get hurt down there in Egypt? When the prophets were called to confront society, they never stopped to wonder, will I be in danger taking up this role? When Jesus considered the major actions of his life, he didn't stop because he asked the question, will I get hurt? Safety and survival are basic animal traits. It's only people who rise above those basic questions that come to higher levels of existence. The second inquiry that Eve makes here is, will it feel good? Our cultural bylaws say that if it hurts, don't do it. If it feels good, go ahead and do it. Somewhere we've been told that pain is bad, and that struggle and strain are negatives that we should avoid at all costs in life. Or perhaps we've been so frightened by life that we don't want to feel good as much as we don't want to feel anything. We want to face life numb. And so that explains our stay-at-home, don't-bug-me, be-entertained-all-the-time mentality, which intends to engulf all of us. I must feel good or I must feel nothing, and all else is bad. And so don't you knock at my door. Don't you put junk flyers in my mail. Don't you put those little cards in my magazine. Don't you call me. Don't you ask me to volunteer. Don't you invade my privacy. Don't interrupt my schedule. Don't you pull in my lane. Don't you touch my car. We want to feel good. Or perhaps we just don't want to feel anything. In order to feel good, though, you must know what it's like to feel bad. We forget that to appreciate a full stomach, you must be hungry. A desire for a warm bed demands a cold day. Satisfaction of a completed job demands facing an undone task. One of the central questions that middle-class Americans use to determine behavior is an offshoot of the question that Eve asks here. Ask somebody to do something that will challenge them in the least little bit, and the response you usually get is, I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable doing that. You mouth that one word, comfortable, and you can get out of a host of tasks in our society. Will you collect for the United Way? Well, I've never been comfortable doing that. Oh, that's okay. We wouldn't want you to feel uncomfortable. Would you please serve on the PTA board? Oh, I've never been comfortable in leadership positions. That's okay. We wouldn't want you to feel uncomfortable. Will you visit Fred over here in the hospital? Well, I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable doing that. Oh, that's okay. We wouldn't want you to feel uncomfortable. Will you serve in this area? I'm not comfortable. Will you reach out to others? I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable. Jesus never used that excuse. Jesus, will you teach the multitudes? I'm sorry, but I'm just not comfortable in front of big crowds. Jesus, would you come over here and heal the sick? I'm sorry, but sick people just make me uncomfortable. Jesus, will you talk to these oppressive religious leaders? I'm sorry, I've just never been comfortable confronting people. It's a catch-all way out. It's an excuse that everybody will accept. But it's nothing more than the question that Eve asked here. Now, there's nothing wrong with feeling good. But who in the world guaranteed us the right to feel good all the time? It's not in the Bible. It's not in the United States Constitution. It's not in the Boy Scout handbook. Where is it written that we must be comfortable all the time? There's nothing wrong with being comfortable. But when our personal comfort zone becomes the criteria by which we make major decisions in life, then we're headed for trouble. There's nothing wrong with good feelings. But judging life by whether it feels good is like evaluating music by its volume, or by buying a car by weight, or like choosing a mate by the number of letters in their first name. It's okay, but used as a major criteria, it leads us astray. Without some higher notion of life, this question, will it feel good, just leads to difficulty and pain. The third question that Eve asked was, what's in it for me? What will I get out of this tree? That question's become the motto of our culture. It's the slogan of our times. It's the question on every mouth. It's the question that drives the criminal and the dope addict and the porno peddler. It's the question that drives the dishonest politician and the deceitful minister. It's the inquiry that makes people move further into the suburbs. It's the cry behind the big lawsuits. It's the motive that makes the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The cry is not, is it right? Or is it fair? Or is it just? The cry is not, is it compassionate? How will it affect my children? What will it do to the environment? What impact would it have on the city? All those questions fall flat in light of the central inquiry of our time. What's in it for me? It was the question that drove the Nazis. It's the issue that leads to dictatorship. It drives the drug lords. It fuels the Hugh Hefners and the Donald Trumps. It's the question on the mind of the arsonist as he lights the match. It's in the head of man in the singles bar who wants to fulfill his emptiness that night, but nothing beyond. It's the motto of the wealthy suburbanite who fills her closet while others sleep on the street. It's the cry of the teenage mother who neglects her child to pursue life with her single friends. If we only ask, what's in it for me, we end up hurting ourselves. If we only ask, what's in it for me, we begin to demand our rights and have less concern for the rights of others. And when we have less concern for the rights of others, they begin to be more concerned about their rights and less concerned about our rights. And it begins a vicious circle of everybody in society asking, what's in it for me? There's another name for that kind of society. It's called barbaric. And there's only one law: might makes right. Again, it's a question that leads to trouble when it's asked with other animal-like inquiries. To ask questions like, is it safe? Will it feel good? What's in it for me? Without bringing any higher standards to bear, is asking for trouble. I suspect that unless you are an unusual person who has some higher calling in life, these three questions rule your life. You're fixated on them. You guide your life by them. You raise your children by them. You buy and spend by them. And you're trapped by them. Furthermore, I suspect that most of the difficulties in our life come because we ask these questions. We've been seduced. We've been tricked by our culture into raising the most animal-like questions to such high authority. They're animal-like because they were introduced into human history by a snake, and because they appeal to the beast in each one of us. It's apparent that Eve took her focus off God and put it on herself. And that's what led to her questions. Next week, I want to look at the right questions that we ask when we keep our minds and our faith focus on God. If you followed the career of Mike Tyson, you know that he's been heavyweight boxing champion. When Mike Tyson steps into the ring, he can whip anybody. Anybody except Mike Tyson. If you follow the reports in the paper, you know about his street fight with boxer Mitch Green, couldn't control his temper. You know about the car accident that most suspect was a form of attempted suicide on Tyson's part. You know about the blow-up of his marriage with actress Robin Givens and the rest of his unraveling of life in front of us. Well, I suppose there's a bit of Mike Tyson in each one of us. It's just that our stories don't appear in the papers. Anger, desire, unfaithfulness, overspending, overeating, overworking. Somewhere we've lost control because we're asking the wrong questions. The only real source of direction in life is God, and He's ready, always ready to help us and to help us put those unraveled lives back together. It begins when we approach Him in trusting faith, that reorientates our whole life, leads us to a point of baptism in water, where He meets us, brings us salvation, and then welcomes us to a life of living in poverty of spirit from then on. If you're stuck in seduction, need to get out, there's people here who can help you. God is always ready to hear your plea. And if you have a plea this morning, pray that you would come as we stand and as we sing.